So, tonight is grief healing in water with Bonnie and Debbie here that are setting up. It's a huge privilege to have these incredibly smart and gifted women here with us to talk about grief healing in water. This evening is part of an ongoing celebration that we've had throughout the month of May here, participating in the Nigani Gichigami water celebration and festival. Okay, so we begin by, as we always do, by acknowledging the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Mississaugas, Anishinaabe First Nations here, and the Dish with One Spoon Treaty that governs the sharing of the Great Lakes between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe. And we're grateful for the opportunity to be here on this land. And we also offer our gratitude for Nigani Gichigami, the great waters that feed and sustain us. So thanks for being here. Bonnie?
Thank you. It's terrific to see such a full room, and it's terrific to see so many familiar faces, to see friends and students and colleagues. I'm Bonnie McElhenney. I teach at the University of Toronto. I teach anthropology and women and gender studies. And as of July 1st, I'll be the principal of New College at the university. New College is the site of social justice programs at the University of Toronto, one of the sites, but it's a large cluster: women and gender studies, equity studies, Buddhist studies, African studies, Caribbean studies. And it's also a place that's increasingly thinking about land, water, and food security issues and placing those in conversation with other social justice issues. So it's a real thrill to have an opportunity to work with that community over the next few years. What I've been doing the last 2 years at the University of Toronto is thinking about water. And we have a grant to put together a cluster of courses on water, to build conversations with community partners, and to think about what it means to be a university on the Great Lakes, to be in a place that has 20% of the world's fresh water, and to think about what it means to live in right relationship with the land and with Indigenous territory and Indigenous peoples in this place. So those are the questions I've been thinking about. The comments I'm going to share tonight are more personal. They are sharing some thoughts on how I personally became involved with thinking about water, and thinking about personal and historic traumas, and how we try to heal both of those with water and building relationships, reciprocal relationships with one another. So I will share a few comments, then I'll introduce Dr. Deb Denard, and she'll share some comments. There'll be a water ceremony. During the water ceremony itself, we're asking, as Lee said, that you not take pictures, but afterwards we're happy to talk to you. And if you're interested in hearing about water events at the University of Toronto, let me know. I have a notebook, and I can sign you up with your email address, and anything that's going on at U of T, you can be plugged into those conversations. So my niece Serena would have been 29 on Saturday. And on the day that Serena posted her last Facebook message, I was paddling on Lake Ontario. It was 2.5 years ago, it was a Sunday, and my husband and my daughter and a friend named Rose and I had launched a canoe and a kayak and a paddleboard from Cherry Beach. Gary was a bit grouchy. He grew up in Toronto. He's still not quite convinced that we should swim and paddle in Lake Ontario. Like many people who grew up in Scarborough, his family went north when they wanted to find the water. So we paddled over to the island, and we paddled the whole way through the canal, and we went back. I started out on the paddleboard so we could get across the Eastern Gap, and then I let Rose try it. There were a lot of people taking pictures. Paddleboards were still a novelty. And it was a good day. It was a sunny September day, and I wasn't on Facebook then, so I didn't see Serena's post. A day and a half later, my sister Rita called me, and it was another good day. I was enjoying that day, too. My kids had just gone back to school, and it was quiet, and I was sitting in a coffee shop reading, and my sister said, "Serena's dead. The police found her body today. She said, I can't breathe. She said, we don't know what they've done with her dog. We don't know what they've done with Leo. We don't know where Leo is. So the last time I had seen Serena, she was paddleboarding with Leo on the front. And I am not afraid that I will cry when I share this story with you today. I am more afraid of the day that comes when I won't cry. The 2007 Canadian Water Attitudes Survey says that Canadians take water for granted. We think there's lots of water. We think it will always be there. We value water, but we are careless with it. And we take other forms of love for granted, too. 45% of Canadians say our most important natural resource is water. But 25% say oil and gas is. If you live in Alberta, 57% of people say oil and gas are the most important natural resource. Oil and gas in Alberta are seen as more important than water. The rates of those who think fresh water is very important to the economy is down to 60%. It's not clear if this is a good thing or a bad thing. Does it mean that people are saying water is not always about economy? Water is about life. Or is it that people are saying now that water is not important? You might not be comfortable talking about water as a natural resource. I'm not. Some people talk about water as a political identity. Canada's fresh water is part of Canada's national identity. Canadians tend to feel fortunate and proud about water. Few feel indifferent. Some feel passionate. Your eyes might be glazing over at this point. You're like, too many numbers, you know, too many statistics. What happened to Serena and what happened to her dog? Do you want more at this point about the Canadian Water Attitudes Survey? Or do you want more of my story, which is also Serena's? What does that tell you about the water and attitudes towards it? About the way we need to think and talk about water, about how water is intimately linked to love and life and grief and healing. The first thing Serena's sister said to me was, I'm not a twin anymore. And I said the wrong thing in response. When someone at the funeral asked me how Serena died, I looked at that person's greedy eyes and I said, today we are talking about her life. And I told some stories. One of them was about Christmas Day when the girls were about 10. Santa brought them kayaks with dolls in them. And I've always liked the image of a sleigh with Santa in it and the kayak streaming behind through the sky. Another story is about frogs. Serena and Tanya loved frogs. They would catch them. They would gently put them down the slide. The day after my wedding, they caught a bunch of frogs. They gave a frog to each person, and we lined them up, and there was a frog jumping contest. Gary's 70-year-old father got down on his knees. He was always rather proper, rather Anglo, always in a button-down shirt. I never saw him in a T-shirt. Was down on his knees, and he was cheering on his frog. And the whole family was laughing hard to see him down there. So people laughed at these stories at the funeral, too. We wanted to remember Serena laughing. Her best friend, Jenna, had brought Leo, her dog. People kept burying their hands in Leo's fur, touching what Serena had touched. Frogs, it turns out, are seen as moving between worlds in many traditions because they're water and land animals. They communicate with the spirits in some traditions. They're signs of things to come. They're sensitive to environmental change. They're vulnerable to toxins. They're often one of the first things to die in a toxic environment. So Serena's best friend, Jenna, thanked me for those stories. She was one of the people that the police had notified first when they found Serena. And she said that Serena was never stopped by a soggy day. Serena and Leo would drop by Jenna's house. They would pull her away from her studies. They were studying to be nurses. And they would go hiking. And Serena would say, waterfalls are always more beautiful in the rain. So they hiked a lot of waterfalls in North Carolina. That first year after Serena died, we sometimes found it hard to breathe, to think, to do anything but talk to each other. Being outside helped, baths helped, flowers, food, and tea. We texted a lot. I took a lot of pictures of pebbles. I put together elaborate packages for my niece and my sister because it felt to me like I was taking care of them. I would put together whatever I could find, rocks, yoga books, coloring books, chocolate. I read book after book about grief and loss, loss of parents, sisters, children, heart attacks, comas, tsunamis, suicides, and untimely illnesses. This is not normal, someone said to me. But what is normal is sometimes crazy, and we have to be a bit deranged to keep imagining the future. Stories help us to do that. So when I came back to work after Serena died, I had to teach about hope, and I had to teach about utopias. So I did a course on water, and I did a course on utopias, and I did a course on social change, unsettling settler colonialism. And in my water course, I asked students to collect stories about water. And there are people in this class who've been to my class. Mike Ormsby is here. He's shared his stories and his art with students in that class. So the students go around and ask people, what is your story about water? Your most significant experience with water? And often they get the response that that's so random. What an odd thing to ask us about, like my most important story about water. One person said to one of my students, I hate water. I hate water. So I'm asking you to think about what you would say if you were asked that question. What is your story about water? And how do we lose track of water? Why is it that we think that's an odd thing to think and talk about? How did I lose track of Serena? Who's lost track of water? Sometimes water is abstract. It's scientific, it's a chemical, it's a hydrological cycle. It's distance from sacred discourses, the idea of thinking about water as sacred. Water becomes abstract when it's taken out of place and taken out of time and taken out of territory and taken out of history, when it's turned into a resource or a commodity. It's not invisible to everyone, but for some it is. Like, my students don't always know where their water comes from or where does it go. I asked them to find the river closest to them, and one student said, oh, that drainage ditch in my backyard, it's the East Fork of the Don. I never knew. So how do we get so abstracted from it that we don't know that? But many people aren't, right? Many people are haunted by water. There are water shutoffs in Detroit. There are boil water advisories on reserves, including those in southern Ontario. It's not just a northern issue. There's wastewater and there are toxic particles on our beach in Toronto after a wet weather event. So the question we're thinking about then is, how do we undo this? How do we undo these ways of losing track of water? How do we reclaim water? How do we re-enchant water? Sometimes we tell stories. We decolonize water. We decommodify water. The Wellington Water Watchers are fighting hard to make sure water is not extracted from aquifers in southern Ontario. There'll be another festival, Waterstock Festival, in June to support that work. We reclaim community control over it. We reestablish our relationship with water. We remember that it's sacred. And we love it, so it can love us back.